Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. 1 year ago, almost to the day of this recording, I sent an email to Dr. Richard Jantz of the University of Tennessee. At the time of our initial conversation, Dr. Jantz was midway through his anthropological research and analysis of a set of bones originally found in 1941 on then Gardner Island, now known as Nicomororo Island. Originally examined by Dr. D.W. Hoodless and determined to be male, the bones were lost and to this day have yet to be located. Fast forward to 2018 and Dr. Jantz's comprehensive analysis of the original Hoodless report. It is Dr. Jantz who has determined that, in his opinion, Dr. Hoodless had it all wrong, and the bones that were originally examined many years ago were in fact that of a woman. A woman that Dr. Jantz believes is none other than Amelia Earhart. Tonight, on the 39th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Dr. Jantz joins us via Zoom from his office in Tennessee to discuss and break down his paper, Amelia Earhart and the Nicomororo Bones, a 1941 analysis versus modern quantitative techniques, in a worldwide exclusive interview. To quote from the abstract of Dr. Jantz's paper, to address the question of whether the Nicomororo bones match estimates of Amelia Earhart's bone lengths, I compare Earhart's bone lengths with the Nicomororo bones using the Mahalanobis distance. This analysis reveals that Earhart is more similar to the Nicomororo bones than 99% of individuals in a large reference sample. This strongly supports the conclusion that the Nicomororo bones belonged to Amelia Earhart. Is this case closed? Is the mystery of the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan solved once and for all? Listen on and judge for yourself. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. We've been talking about this interview for quite some time, and now that time is upon us. Joining us from his office in Tennessee is Dr. Richard Jantz. He is the author of the paper Amelia Earhart and the Nicomororo Bones, a 1941 analysis versus modern quantitative techniques. Dr. Jantz has been, of course, at the forefront of the Amelia Earhart disappearance case, at least for the last few weeks, and he is here in an exclusive interview. This is the first time he sat down since the paper has released, and he's going to dive into this paper with us in great detail, and we're going to break it down for everybody. Dr. Jantz, I know you're busy. I really appreciate you doing this for us. Welcome to Chasing Earhart, sir.
My pleasure.
Okay, so before we get to this, let's get a little housekeeping out of the way. Dr. Jantz, can you do me a favor and tell everybody a little bit about your education and your professional background, please?
Well, I'm a biological anthropologist. I studied for my PhD at the University of Kansas, 1970, so it's been a long time ago. And I have been interested in bones and in statistics from the very beginning. So what I do is basically quantitative analysis of bone dimensions. So I have been at the University of Tennessee since 1971 and retired in 2010. Now I have a lot more time to do things that I like.
And, you know, since you mentioned it, I didn't know that you graduated from the University of Kansas. We happen to live in Atchison. We're about three blocks away from Amelia Earhart's house that she grew up in right now as we're recording this. So I learned something new today. Now, the second question I ask to start every interview is really interesting because everybody seems to come to Earhart for different ways and in different means. But what I'd like to know, and it really is a two-part question, is do you have any early recollections of Amelia Earhart? And secondly, when did Amelia Earhart come into your life in a professional sense?
You know, I can't even answer the question when she came into my consciousness prior to my professional engagement. I was aware that she had gone missing, but it wasn't something that occupied a great deal of my time. And I came into it in 1998 professionally via Tiger, and Tiger was working with an anthropologist named Carr Burns. And in 1998, the report of Dr. Hoodless was found in archives in London, and it had these measurements. So Carr recommended that Tiger bring me on to analyze these numbers. And we did a paper that was presented at the American Anthropological Association in 1998, and it was preliminary in nature, but we said that these bones were consistent with Amelia Earhart. And the matter lay more or less dormant until 2015, at which time the paper by Sam Cross and Richard Wright came out, and I felt that they had misrepresented what Dr. Hoodless could do, that they gave him more credit for being able to accurately develop what we call the biological profile of a skeleton, that is age, sex, ancestry, height. And it was no criticism of Dr. Hoodless's competence. I think he was as competent as any physician of the time. But the science of forensic anthropology was in its infancy. And we know that forensic anthropologists today still make errors. And I evaluated the methods he used, and they were, to a considerable extent, prone to errors. So the paper really has two parts. One part addresses Dr. Hoodless and the possibility that he may have not been correct. And then the second part goes into much more detail about what we can tell about Amelia Earhart in order to match her to the Nakumarora bones and make an informed decision about whether they fit her or whether they do not, whether she can be included or excluded.
So I think the question that is really on everyone's mind, and really the figure that's on everyone's mind and sort of stuck with everybody, is 99%. As I'm sure you have seen, there have been many recent articles in the news about your research regarding Amelia Earhart and the Nikumaroro bones. Now, a lot of these news agencies are using titles that state that you are, in fact, 99% sure that the skeletal material from Hoodless's sample, in fact, belongs to Amelia Earhart. Now, as it turns out, these news articles are referencing the following quote from your paper's abstract, and I'll quote it. Quote, "This analysis reveals that Earhart is more similar to the Nikumaroro bones than 99% of individuals in a large reference sample. This strongly supports the conclusion that the Nikumaroro bones belonged to Amelia Earhart." Now, upon reading through your recently released article, it's clear that you completed many different analyses of the data using various reference samples. So it seems that in the above quote, you are referring to one of those samples. Now, with that being said, would you agree with the titles of many of the aforementioned news articles that suggest that you are, in fact, 99% sure that the material is, in fact, Amelia Earhart?
I think in general, yes. But if, you know, 99% is not 100%, and rare events do occur. But I would say that if it's not Amelia Earhart, then it's someone very similar to her. And as the results in the paper show, that's an unlikely event. So if it's not Amelia Earhart, then it's some random person. And a random person has a low probability of having bone proportions similar to Amelia Earhart.
So I think at this point we should probably step back a moment and break down some fundamental anthropological terms. And let's start off with taphonomy. Now, many of our listeners are very interested in learning more about the original skeletal material examined by Hoodless since it was studied many years ago and it's no longer available to analyze. Now, to begin, as Hoodless states in his April 4th, 1941 report, which we will have a link to in the show notes for this show, and as you reiterate in your recent article, and I'll quote again, quote, "All these bones are very weather-beaten and have been exposed to the open air for a considerable time. Except in one or two small areas, all traces of muscular attachments and the various ridges and prominences have been obliterated." Now, it seems that this material had been greatly affected by taphonomic changes when Hoodless observed it. For our listeners who are young and who are looking into this as a career field, can you talk a little bit about the word taphonomy and what that exactly is?
Taphonomy is the study of what happens to a body from the time of death until it is discovered. So it includes anything at all that can happen to it. Obviously, a body decomposes. The way in which it decomposes depends upon the environmental circumstances it's in. It depends upon scavengers, whether they're present or not, and which ones are present. It depends on the weather. It depends on the insects. So it's just whatever happens to the bones or to the body from the time it is a dead body until someone comes upon it. And then, so when you discover human remains of any kind anywhere, you try to make taphonomic inferences about what kind of circumstances led to the bones as you now see them.
Now, before we go any further, let's talk about the elephant in the room. And by elephant, I mean, of course, the crab in the room, and that's the Nicomororo crabs. They're a big part. They're really the wild card of this hypothesis. I want to ask you sort of your thoughts on this. Now, in your study, you state that, and I'll quote, damage to the bones was most likely due to scavenging by crabs, end quote. This was originally observed by Gallagher, and it's currently being investigated by Dr. Tom King, and we talked about that on our NICU 9 recap episode just a few weeks ago. Without getting too much into that hypothesis itself, what types of taphonomic changes to the Nicomororo skeletal material could be attributed to an animal like a crab?
Well, I should qualify what I'm going to say, and that I'm not an expert in taphonomy. All I know about the Nicomororo crabs is that they are capable of taking down a body fairly fast. And what they do to bones, I don't really have a whole lot of personal knowledge of, kind of going off what others have said. That is basically that it's more likely crab activity than weather beating, as Hoodless described it. The thing about taphonomy is that there are many, many outcomes, and without knowing the situation better than we do, you can't really say what all has happened to the bones. But one of the principal uses of taphonomy, especially now in modern forensic anthropology, is to estimate how long a body has been dead. So when you find bones, they are in some stage of decomposition, and we know enough about taphonomy of modern people now to be able, in many cases, to make a pretty good estimate of how long the bones have been there. But in the case of the Nicomororo Island bones, we don't really know the circumstances. I know that, you know, there were estimates at the time that maybe these bones had been there a very long time, and that maybe the 3 years between Earhart's disappearance and the discovery of the bones was not enough time for the taphonomic changes that Hoodless observed to occur. And I would just say that I don't think you can say that with much confidence.
Now, Dr. Jantz, other than the crabs, I know Nicomororo can be a very nasty place. It can be very beautiful, but very pristine, but it can also turn on a dime, and it can have a lot of inclement weather. Obviously, there's other taphonomic changes that could possibly have an effect on these Nicomororo bones. Is that something that you looked into during your research and during the phase of kind of looking into what could have had an effect on those bones in particular? I know the weather out there is bad. We've talked about it a lot in the podcast. That can obviously have an effect on the bones and what and the specimens that you're working with as well, correct?
Sure, it could have. And I really didn't concern myself much with that because, although Hoodless is not so precise in how he describes the bones, it does seem that they were in good enough shape that he could get lengths of them. He did not qualify his length measurements. And he also took measurements of the cranium, and he did not qualify those as having been affected by taphonomic changes. So I'm thinking that the remains had, as he said, the muscle attachment areas and ridges and crests and things like that worn down, which could certainly be crabs. It might be other things too.
Interesting. Okay. Now, as we know from your article, Hoodless measured the skeletal material based on Pearson's study from 1899, and of course we'll have a link to that study in the show notes for this episode. But per Pearson, and per more recent methods of skeletal measurement in forensic anthropology, it's often understood that skeletal measurements are taken by measuring from one specific point on a bone to another for the purpose of accuracy across researchers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you tell the listeners about skeletal measurements in forensic anthropology and how this data specifically is most accurately obtained?
Well, measuring bones is as old as anthropology. That was one of the first things that early anthropologists started doing. And in the early days, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, a lot of the measuring of bones and skulls in particular was used in racial typology. That is, you'd use measurements to say, this is what Mongoloids look like, this is what Negroids look like, this is what Caucasoids look like. And a lot of what the early anthropologists did with those measurements has been debunked, and in some cases it was categorized as scientific racism. And in any case, there often was a kind of a hierarchical view of human races, with Europeans, of course, at the pinnacle and other groups below that. But since the mid to late 20th century, measuring has become much more, I don't know, extravagant maybe. We now, we used to do it with calipers, where you had specific points on the skull or the other bones that you would measure, and there were definitions given for these. The definitions go back mainly to early German anthropologists. So the idea is that if I follow the definitions and measure a bone, and you do the same thing, we will get the same answer or a very similar answer, so that the measurements are comparable across different observers. You know, now we do a lot of measuring with 3D equipment. We have a digitizer and it gives you XYZ coordinates of these points. Or you can get information from a CT scan or a laser scan about the size and shape of a bone, of the skull or of the postcranial bone. And statistics have evolved to the point where you can do a lot more with those measurements. And the emphasis now is, depending on what you're doing, and if you're interested in paleoanthropology, then you look at the kinds of changes that have occurred from some millions of years to the present. Or if you're interested in human variation of present day people, and you look at the data you have from people from different regions of the world and ask how they're related and how similar or different they are, and how evolutionary forces might have brought these differences into being. In forensic anthropology, we use measurements to identify what is normally called ancestry. It used to be called race, but it's now ancestry. And so when a forensic case comes into your laboratory, it's unidentified, so you know nothing about it. The investigating agency usually brings the bones in, or we go out and recover them for an investigating agency. And what we do is develop a biological profile as the first step. And so we use the measurements to estimate the sex, the ancestry, the height, and age. These estimates are made by using reference samples where we know these things. So we have criteria. We can say that this person is Euro-American or African-American or Hispanic in America. And in other parts of the world, there are similar kinds of, complex population structure. But the questions you would ask in Brazil, for example, are different than the U.S.
And that's a great segue into the next question, and that's one that a lot of people have been wondering about since this paper broke. Can you speak to a forensic anthropologist's ability to accurately measure skeletal material that is missing some or even all of its prominences? I mean, that's got to play a role in the work that you're doing there.
Oh, sure, it can. It depends on what's missing.
I see.
In the case of modern forensic cases, it is often the case that carnivores, such as dogs or coyotes or other creatures, find the body, and one of the first things they do is chew off the ends. So you've got a bone that doesn't have its ends, which makes it impossible to get an accurate length. On the skull, animal activity is usually less destructive, but other things, you know, if the body is buried, pressure from the earth may distort the skull or break it. When there's taphonomic destruction, it puts some limitations on what information you can get from measuring.
Now, interestingly enough, in Hoodless's original analysis of the skeletal material, he states that a, quote, mandible with only four teeth in position, end quote, was uncovered along with the rest of the material.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any thoughts as to why Hoodless did not analyze the dentition?
Well, if I have any thoughts, they're purely speculative. You know, it's a very interesting question of whether Hoodless was aware that he might be looking at the remains of Amelia Earhart. He makes no mention of that, but what you would do now, if you had the remains he was looking at, is you would determine whether those teeth had any reconstructions, any dental work. Then you would ask whether the suspected missing person, in this case Amelia Earhart, also had dental work. And I think I have read, I'm not certain about this, that she did not have any dental work. I'm not sure if Hoodless mentioned that there were no restorations. One of the early people who saw the skeleton did mention that there were no restorations. But, you know, if we had that mandible now, and if Amelia Earhart had ever been to a dentist and there were x-rays, we could carry out a typical match and include her or exclude her.
Yeah, and you know, as you were just talking about the dentition and the mandible, I thought of something that has been sort of thrown around the Earhart community for a long period of time, and that is whether or not Amelia Earhart had something done known as a Caldwell-Luke procedure.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, that is something that would have certainly factored in, at least to Hoodless's original report, if he was looking at a skull that had two dime-sized incisions in it. If that was something that Dr. Hoodless was able to identify, I imagine that would have, I don't want to say it would have been a smoking gun, but it would have been probably the closest thing to a smoking gun. Am I correct on that? Would that have helped?
I don't really know much about that procedure. I understand that it does leave marks on the bone, so there would be evidence of the surgery that she had to relieve a sinus issue. I think what we have to assume is that just because Hoodless didn't mention it doesn't mean it wasn't there, because his report was very superficial. He estimated sex, and he was very certain of his estimate. Because if you look at his report, he says this is definitely a male, and it's capitalized and underlined. He kind of hedges on some of the other things, so he says probably European, or perhaps what he called a half-caste, a European islander mix. So he wasn't going to make a definite pronouncement there. And the height he gave, he was fairly certain of the height based on Pearson's formulae. There is an interesting thing that, you know, you have to read every word of the paper to find this, but there is an error in one of Hoodless's formulae. There is also a medical text that has the very same error. It suggests that Hoodless did not consult Pearson's original paper. And what he did consult, we do not know. I think that would be kind of an interesting historical question, because there might have been some English text of the time concerning forensic pathology that included this stature stuff and included the error that Hoodless used in his formula. And it didn't make much difference in the actual stature estimation, but it does suggest that he did not consult Pearson himself. That's also suggested by the fact that he did not mention a paper by Pearson that actually gave good sexing information for the femur, and he had the femora. He did not do any extensive extra work to try to get this thing nailed down as well as he could.
Now, Dr. Jantz, I do like to play the devil's advocate in our show sometimes, just so we can kind of get some of the questions out that some of our listeners might be thinking about as they're listening to this conversation that you and I are having this evening. One of those questions is, and I'll just ask it bluntly, isn't it more likely that the bones, the Nicomoro bones, are that of one of the victims of the SS Norwich City wreckage that was so famously wrecked off the coast of Gardner Island at the time, now Nicomoro? I know there were about 11 people that lost their lives in that wreck. Isn't it more likely that the bones that Dr. Hoodless originally saw and the bones that you are working on and that you wrote this paper about are in fact one of those men?
Well, sure, that's always been a possibility. I think what has not been documented is that any of the ones unaccounted for actually survived. So there are, I don't remember the exact number now, but I think there were like 35 crew and 11 either perished or were unaccounted for.
Right, yeah. There were 11 people that died on the Norwich City wreckage. 6 of them were of Arabian descent and 5 of them were European. Uh-huh. There were 2 bodies of the Europeans and 1 Arabian body that was recovered. So that makes 5 Arabians and 3 Europeans that were never found. And I wonder if, one of those bodies was one of the Europeans. It would explain a lot of things, and I think that certainly plays the wild card here.
Well, sure. And what it would have to mean is that one of those people unaccounted for made it to the island but was unable to hook up with the others that were subsequently rescued. So I think that is a possibility. I think that needs to be looked at in more detail. We do have some estimates of the heights of the, some documentation of the heights of some of the ones that were unaccounted for. And those would be the European or the English people. We do not have any heights from the Arabs or Yamanis. Now, it is the case that if one of them happened to be a Yamani, that person would probably qualify as a stocky male.
Right.
Because they are shorter and they tend to be more mesomorphic.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I have read about Yamani head form, they tend to have very short, broad crania, and the Nicomoro skull is rather narrow and long. Without doing any analysis, I would say that the head form of the Nicomorora skull, using the measurements given by Hoodless, it would be inconsistent with most Yamanis. And I think we haven't done this yet, but we should be able to include or exclude the people from which we have height. So there's more research that needs to be done on that score. But the other thing that I think you have to deal with if you want to propose that it's a Norwich City survivor is the artifacts that were found in 1940 at the site where the skeleton was found. And that would be the sextant box, the Benedictine bottle, and then part of a woman's shoe. None of those things, certainly the sextant box, which Tiger has identified as being of American manufacture from the numbers that the discoverers recorded, that presumably there would not have been such an artifact with a survivor of the Norwich City, because he would have been lucky to get himself there, much less a sextant box, even if he had one. What I think you are faced with, if you wish to propose that, it's not a parsimonious explanation, because then it requires independent events. You have to get the skeleton there, and then you have to get the sextant box and the other stuff there as another event.
Now, you just mentioned TIGER, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. Of course, as anyone knows who's been following Chasing Earhart and our project, and of course, as anybody knows that's been following the Amelia Earhart disappearance case in the last 30 years or so, TIGER is a name that has sort of been synonymous with the Amelia Earhart investigation, and they have built this list of circumstantial evidence on the island of Nikumaroro by working that island for over 30 years now, most recently this past summer. I wanted to ask you how much their data and their evidence and their information has helped influence the findings that you have had on this paper. How much did it assist you? What role did that play? And what was the importance of TIGER's work on this island over the course of the last three decades for you?
Well, TIGER was indispensable. Rick has all these connections. And as I began to think about what we might say about Amelia Earhart, I started asking him about photographs that might have a scalable object. And we found this one that's reproduced in the paper of her holding an oil can, and Rick put me in touch with Jeff Blickman, the forensic photographer, and Jeff actually purchased an oil can like the one she's holding on eBay and measured it and provided a scale, so he was able to tell me how many pixels per inch were in that photo, and that enabled me to estimate where her radius started and ended and where her humerus started and ended and convert those pixels into absolute dimensions. So that was really the Rosetta Stone that kind of broke it open, because as far as I'm aware, nothing like that has been accomplished in the past. And then there's also the issue of the length of her tibia, and there are no photos that we have found that show her tibia or show her calf exposed, so you could estimate where her tibia starts and ends with a scalable object. And you know, she typically wore trousers, so and seemed to avoid dresses whenever possible. So we got from Purdue, Rick's connections at Purdue University Archives, a pair of her trousers, and Paula Guernsey, the historic seamstress, took very precise measurements of her trousers. One of the measurements was inseam length, which gave us the information we could use to get a better estimate of her tibia length. And also we got her waist circumference from the waist circumference of the trousers. And that was important in estimating her weight. That didn't play directly into comparing the Nikumaroro bones to Amelia Earhart, but it did enable us to say that the weight recorded on her pilot's license is probably an underestimate. Her pilot's license says she's 5'8 and weighs 118 pounds, which is pretty close to emaciated. We don't think that she weighed 118 pounds. 130 is the most likely.
Now, Dr. Jantz, in your paper, you discussed the limitations of using Hoodless's original cranial measurements to determine ancestry. Further, in your analysis of Hoodless's original sex estimation, you stated that, quote, "The most prudent position concerning sex of the Nikumaroro bones is to consider them unknown," end quote. Mm-hmm. And later, showing how some parts of the skeletal material could be suggestive of male, while other parts could be suggestive of female. Mm-hmm. Can you discuss the concept of an indeterminate conclusion in forensic anthropology and why elements of a biological profile such as sex and ancestry and estimation are not always an exact science in that field?
Well, sure. From the skull itself, if you have good measurements, and by good I mean accurate and plentiful, you know, usually we would want 20 or more from the skull, you still can only get about 90% of them correct. So there's a known error of 10% under the best of circumstances from the skull alone. What we had from Dr. Hoodless was four measurements. length and breadth of the skull, and then height and width of the orbit. And it's a little bit of a mystery to me why he chose the orbit as something he should measure. There are other more obvious things, and certainly more things that would contribute to sex, such as the width of the face. That's pretty dimorphic, but he did not take those measurements. So with the measurements he did provide, the Nakumarora bones classify as female, but not with a high level of confidence. So what I think I said is that the bones, that the skull points to female, but you can't put a lot of confidence in the estimate. And the bone lengths themselves are clearly in the male range. So if you sex the Nakumarora bones on bone length, they would classify as male. But that's also true of Amelia Earhart. If we knew we had her bone lengths, they would classify as male, just because she was taller than most females and even a little taller than the average male of the time.
Let's move on to four-disc. It's something that plays prominently in your career, and it plays prominently in this particular report. For our listeners who do not have experience in forensic anthropology, can you discuss the creation of the four-disc computer program along with Stephen Owsley, and how has four-disc changed over the years, and how is it most commonly implemented in bioarchaeology and forensics today in a modern age?
Well, I think the answer to the question of bioarchaeology is it's not used that much. Occasionally it is. Let me just tell you how four-disc came into being. Prior to the mid-80s, ancestry and sex estimation from measurements was done via something called discriminant function analysis. That is a multivariate statistical technique that takes several measurements and uses them to develop a formula, an equation, that you can use to classify an unknown. And the way that worked from about the early 1960s was about the first application of this in forensic anthropology, was that you would do it, you know, using old 80 column computer cards, and you would develop the function, and then you would publish it in a paper, and forensic anthropologists would then use that equation to estimate sex or ancestry. In the mid-80s, we started the forensic anthropology database, and that the idea in the forensic anthropology database was that forensic anthropologists are an elite group of scientists in the sense that they are the only ones that get to look at the skeletons of modern people. And by modern people, I mean people with 20th century birth years. So that forensic cases that forensic anthropologists see all the time are people that are born in the 20th century. We're far enough into the 21st that now we're getting some with 21st century birth years. When a skeleton comes into a forensic anthropology lab, if everything goes right, the skeleton is identified, and then the family claims it. And so it's gone, and they bury it or cremate it. The rationale of the forensic data bank was that we would try and recover information from these forensic cases while they're in the lab, and then when they become identified, we know their age, their race, their sex, their height, all of those things. And then that turned out to be very interesting, because modern 20th century people are a lot different from 19th century people, and we know that. So using forensic cases, we were able to develop a database of modern people. Once that database became established, which would have been in the mid-80s, it occurred to me that we could develop software that would read this database and calculate these discriminant functions kind of on the fly, as we say, so that it would do a new function every time you put in a new case. and that function could be designed using, you know, your graphical interface to choose the groups you wanted to compare your forensic case to choose the measurements you wanted to use or had available. So that was the rationale behind 4Disc. I wrote the code for the first version of 4Disc in 1990. And I was very fortunate to have a very talented graduate student at the time named Steve Owsley, who became a far better programmer than me. And so he basically redid 4Disc 1, which I had written, in Visual Basic, and it became 4Disc 2. And then 4Disc 3 is what we're now using. And the evolution just involved increasing features, increasing capability, increasing the database that it can read, and increasing the flexibility that you have. So now 4Disc's primary use is in forensic applications in the U.S. Now, 4Disc also has a world database that was collected by a guy named Howells, W.W. Howells, who was a pioneer in statistical analysis of cranial measurements. And so 4Disc has that database too. That is the one that you can use occasionally in bioarchaeology. And I know that, you know, museums often have skeletal collections, and sometimes these collections are not very well documented and they don't know where a skull came from. You may also know that many indigenous groups, such as Native Americans in the U.S. or Australian Aboriginals in Australia, or indigenous groups in other parts of the world, are now making claims on skeletons that museums hold of people they regard as ancestors. So sometimes a museum just doesn't know where a skull came from because the records are so bad. And so 4Disc can help them sometimes sort that out.
Okay, so we're going to switch gears here a little bit and talk about another term that's prominent in your paper and in your work, and that term is known as the Mahalanobis distance. And it's one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about. Since it comes up frequently, obviously, in your study, can you explain the significance of the Mahalanobis distance and why this distance is important, especially in your comparison of the Nicomororo material to your Earhart estimations?
Well, okay. P.C. Mahalanobis was a very talented statistician of Indian descent. He did a paper in the 30s. Where he worked out this distance, and it has come to be known as the Mahalanobis distance. Now, historically, that's very interesting because Pearson, the guy that did the formulae for estimating height, also had a way of doing distances among crania usually. The thing about measurements of the human body, whether it's skulls or living people, whatever, is that these measurements are always correlated. If you take a measurement of, you know, humerus length, that's going to be correlated with radius length. Or if you take a measurement of face width, that's going to be correlated with head width. Pearson's distance ignored those correlations. And the significance of the Mahalanobis distance is that he worked out how to uncorrelate the measurements so that a measurement only contributes its unique information and not that information that overlaps with other measurements. In the case I was dealing with, where I had humerus, radius, and tibia, those bones are all highly correlated. So I was able to use the Mahalanobis distance to compare the Nicomororo bones to my reference sample and to Amelia Earhart by uncorrelating them and getting the combination of size and shape. Anytime you have more than one measurement. There's a size component and a shape component. Both of those components are captured in the Mahalanobis distance while getting rid of the correlation that exists among the bones. And that's a fairly academic point, I suppose, but the Mahalanobis distance is one of the great statistical inventions. It is still used very commonly today.
Now, as you state in your paper regarding a Z-score of negative 2.38 in your analysis of the sex of the bones, and I'll quote from the paper, quote, "One might argue that if the Nicomororo bones are actually those of Amelia Earhart, the distance should be zero, but that expectation is unrealistic for at least two reasons. One, it would require that my estimates of bone lengths were made without error, which is highly unlikely. And two, it would require that Hoodless measured the Nicomororo bones without error, which is also highly unlikely," end quote. Now, can you elaborate on this statement and why studying skeletal samples in these conditions can be particularly challenging?
Well, the challenge, of course, in this case is we do not know the error, and some criticisms have emerged already, and they're valid points, I suppose. I say that we cannot rely on his sex estimation, so how can we rely on his measurements? So it's argued that I'm trying to have it both ways, reject the sex estimation when I don't like it and accept the measurements when I do. And what I would say is that measuring is a lot easier than sexing, for one thing. And I do not have any idea what kind of equipment Hoodless had available and how well trained he was, although it is not difficult to measure the length of a bone. One interesting thing I did note is that when he took the measurements of the eye orbit, he records them to a tenth of a millimeter. And we wouldn't do that today. We would we'd take them to the nearest millimeter. And so he did have some kind of an instrument that would measure to a tenth of a millimeter, which kind of suggests that he had decent equipment. And of course, he has to know what he's doing in order for the measurements to a tenth of a millimeter to mean anything. My general impression of the measurements that he provided is that they are realistic. You know, I've dealt with enough bones and their lengths and the statistics that they provide to know when something is obviously out of kilter. His measurements seem realistic to me. It is the case, if I measure bones and you measure bones, they will differ. Usually, those differences will be 1 or 2 millimeters and won't make any major contribution to the result. That's basically the assumptions I'm operating from.
So, Dr. Jantz, is it fair for me to say that you are confident in the original measurements of Dr. Hoodless and his report? I imagine if you would have actually had the specimens in hand, it would have been a whole different ballgame. But in the case of this particular report, obviously we didn't have those. So you had to rely heavily on Dr. Hoodless's report and his observations. So is it a fair statement for me to say that you are confident in those original notes?
There's nothing in the measurements he took that would make you think he did them incorrectly. The numbers he got are realistic. You know, who knows what kind of training he had, but, you know, like I say, measuring bone lengths is not that difficult. Measuring orbit height and orbit breadth, that's more challenging. We do not know exactly how he did it. He did not give us a definition. But the measurements are what you would get on an ordinary skull in that range.
Now, if we turn our attention back to your analysis of Earhart's measurements, it seems that you used a variety of intriguing methods to collect your data for this study. For instance, you mentioned that a historic clothing seamstress took the measurements of Earhart's trousers and jacket, and that Jeff Glickman of Fotech took estimations using items such as a can of mobile lubricant. Do you think that implementing many different types of analytical methods like this makes your study even stronger?
Sure. Where we are now is that we have Nicomororo bones. The evidence that we could develop from Amelia Earhart does not allow us to exclude her, and in fact argues for including her. The way I like to frame this whole thing is that we're testing a hypothesis. So there are really, I guess, three major hypotheses about what happened to Amelia Earhart. One of them is the crash and sank hypothesis. Another one is that she was captured by the Japanese. And then there's the Nakumarora Island hypothesis. And that's the hypothesis we are testing. And scientific hypotheses normally can't be proven. They can be supported or falsified.
Right.
And the Nakumarora Island hypothesis, I think, is strongly supported by the evidence developed and put in that paper. Now, it is a scientific hypothesis, so it can be falsified. My idea is that the hypothesis and the data are out there, and if someone can falsify the hypothesis, then fine, we'll have learned something. Or, you know, in the case of the other two hypotheses, I do not believe there is much scientific evidence that would support them. And I think the Nakumarora Island hypothesis has more support than any other. And the crashed and sank, that's a difficult one because they have to find something at the bottom of the ocean in order to find support for that hypothesis. And they have not done that yet.
Now, you just mentioned the Japanese capture hypothesis. It's one that is frequently talked about on Chasing Earhart. We've had several episodes dedicated to that with some of the experts working that particular case. I wanted to ask you about photograph evidence because, as we all know, the Lost Evidence Project that came out last summer and actually the Jaluit dock photo that dropped during the anniversary of the disappearance sort of set the whole world on fire in the same manner that your paper has. And I wanted to ask a little bit about photography and how that plays a role in working a varying hypothesis. And many listeners of Chasing Earhart are also interested in the validity of bone length estimations based on photographs. Can you discuss this method in particular and its overall validness?
I am certainly not an expert photographer or even a mediocre one. And so I rely on Jeff Glickman. My expertise involved estimating where the bones were from, in the picture, of course, she's got flesh. You cannot see the bones directly, except you can see the end of the radius pretty well. What I would say is that my estimates of where the bones start and end will have error, but it cannot be major error. It cannot be very large because there are only certain places where these bones can start and end. Maybe to lend it more credibility, there should be an error analysis, and that might be pretty involved, but it would involve photographing people holding a scalable object like Amelia Earhart is doing, estimating where their bone lengths are from the photos, and then measuring them on the person so that we could get an error estimate that way. But like I say, it would be some effort.
Another interesting question to ask is regarding DNA. If you still had access to the skeletal material from the Hoodless study, do you think the DNA would have been viable at this point?
No way to know that. Tropical environments are tough on DNA. We have the whole genome for Neanderthals. Their DNA survives because they're in cold climates. And extracting DNA from bones in the tropics has been much less successful. Now, of course, with Neanderthals, we're talking 50, 60,000 years ago, which is a long time for DNA to survive. And in the case of the Nakumarora bones, we're talking 80 years. It is possible that DNA could be extracted from the Nakumarora bones if they were present.
On the NICU 9 recap episode, we talked with Dr. Tom King about the soil samples that they collected at this latest trip. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on obtaining DNA from those soil samples.
Well, it's the same thing as getting it from bones. Now, I know they've gotten DNA from Neanderthal caves from the soil. Again, that's a cold environment. The DNA in the soil in the Kumamura Island presents the same problem. It's an adverse environment for survival of DNA, which isn't to say that some couldn't. If you get DNA, then it's going to be pretty fragmented. But still, if you get something, you might be able to make an identification that way.
Now, importantly, you also stated in your study that you were able to eliminate Fred Noonan as a possible match to the skeletal material because his documented height was 6'1¼".
Mm-hmm.
And his tall height rules him out as a match to the Nikumaroro sample. However, and as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, we spoke about the 1929 Norwich City wreck in which 11 men were killed. Although there is no data available to test the Nikumaroro material against the Norwich City victims, what are your thoughts on the significance of this wreck and whether or not the material could belong to one of those men instead?
What I would say is that it is possible, but unlikely. And the reason I say it's unlikely is from the data in the paper, which show that most people would be rather far removed from the Nikumaroro bones. So a person on the North City would have been presumably a random person as far as those bones are concerned. So it's improbable, but possible, that a North City castaway could be the Nikumaroro bones. Then it would be someone very similar to Amelia Earhart.
Although you seem to leave things pretty open to a certain amount of interpretation in your paper, for you personally, what is the single most convincing piece of evidence for this skeletal material belonging to Amelia Earhart?
Well, it'd be the good old Mahalanobis distance. She has a low distance to the Nikumaroro bones, which you would not expect if they're not her. I do agree that it's possible that the bones could look like her, even though they're not her, but it seems pretty unlikely.
So after all of this, after everything we've discussed today, we really only have one question left, and I guess that's really the obvious question after all of this. Is this case closed? Is this mystery solved, in your professional opinion?
Even if it is closed, in my eyes, it's not closed. If you've been following any of the popular press, there have been some pretty critical articles appearing. And so I think it's irrelevant what I personally think. What is relevant is the science that's brought to bear on it. And I think that we are now at the stage where, well, I hope we're at the stage where we approach these hypotheses scientifically, and that their support or falsifiability is based on evidence. And I do understand that people who hold other views have pretty strong emotional investments in those views and don't want to let go of them unless they absolutely have to. And I personally, I think, will probably get into some other avenues of investigation on the Amelia case. For example, I think I will try to rule in or out Yamanis based on head form and maybe the North City unaccounted for. So there are still some things that can be done. What I would also say is that people who do not wish to accept the support for the Nikumaroro hypothesis should do more than just say, I don't believe it. I think, you know, there should be some evidence that it's not correct, that there are some errors, or that the data really do not support it, and the statistical analysis is flawed, whatever. I hope it stays in the realm of scientific hypothesis testing. If you look at it as a forensic case, and, you know, there is a lot of emphasis on what they call cold cases now, and we have in our collection here at the University of Tennessee a lot of skeletons that are unidentified. And those DNA samples from those skeletons are now being submitted, and occasionally we get a hit and someone is identified. Well, Amelia Earhart is a very cold case. I do make clear in my paper that the probabilities that I've developed would not qualify as a positive identification in a modern forensic case, where even a DNA identification is not 100%. It might be one in a million, but that's still not 100%. And I'm saying 99%, which is only one in 100. You can argue that that's too conservative or not conservative enough, but the fact remains that the Nakumarora bones are very similar to what I've reconstructed for Amelia Earhart. In order for the Nakumarora hypothesis to be falsified, it needs to be done with evidence. And the way I see it, you know, if someone comes up with bones in Saipan and those bones can be linked to Amelia Earhart with a high degree of probability, then that would presumably falsify my hypothesis. There have been bones found in Saipan, and they have been examined, and they were thought to be Amelia Earhart, but they were pronounced to be those of a Micronesian. Short of finding skeletal remains elsewhere, or finding the aircraft on the bottom of the ocean, I think that the only way to falsify my hypothesis is to deal with what I have put forth and show that it's not accurate in some sense that would falsify it.
Dr. Jantz, I only have one final question before we wrap up this interview, and that is, of course, about impact and legacy. You, of all people, might be in a really great position to answer this because you have been at the center of this whirlwind for this paper release and everything, all the attention that it's garnered, you personally and your work. My question is, why is the world continually so fascinated with the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan? And why is it that every time a story comes out in the news that has Amelia Earhart's name attached to it, whether it's your paper, whether it's the Lost Evidence Project that came out last year, whether it's her 1932 SX Terraplane getting stolen and then recovered in Los Angeles, whether it's the International Women's Day Barbie selling out for Amelia Earhart for pre-orders, what is it about Amelia Earhart specifically that seems to capture the imagination of this entire world, and why do people care so much about her fate and the fate of Fred Noonan? Can you explain that?
No, I can't. I mean, for me personally, I think I would have to honestly say that I had not paid that much attention to Amelia Earhart before I got into the possible analysis of the bones. And the thing is that what I did with Amelia Earhart, although not typical of what you would do with a normal forensic case, was still that kind of an approach. Because we have unknown skeletal remains come into our lab all the time. And it's always a challenge to figure out who they are. So for me, Amelia Earhart was more of an identification challenge than to enter the fray of Amelia Earhart hype. And I guess all I would say is that she was a pioneer and very well known at the time. She had this mysterious disappearance, and the circumstances of her disappearance were that no one knew where she was. Why she has developed such a following all over the world, I don't really have a good answer. But it is what it is.
Dr. Jantz, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I'll give everybody a little bit of exposition before we wrap up here. About a year ago, I reached out to you via email. You must have been sort of right in the middle of your paper, right in the middle of your project. And you had told me then that you'd be happy to come on the show once the paper was out. And you are indeed a man of your word. You were happy to come back on the show and talk with us after all that time, so I really want to say thank you. It means a lot to myself and our team and everybody who's listening to the show right now to get that exposition and to get that breakdown from you like we've been doing for the last hour or so here. I want to thank you very much for your time. I know you have a lot going on. I know you've kind of been really busy with all this, so thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast and being official guests of Chasing Earhart. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow the project on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join us next week as we welcome project guest and the host of Skeptoid, Brian Dunning. Thanks for listening.